you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggles of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Brussell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. My first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, and Tubi. And my second feature is three pages from being finished. Yay!
What?
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently in pre-production of my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant and producer's rep, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome Ren, the girl with the mark, co-creators, directors, writers, Kate Madison and Christopher Dane, and current showrunner, DP and writer, Neil Osman on the show to talk about how they made two seasons of a fantasy web series on a $40K budget per season. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. But first, Ulrich, how are you?
I am doing well. You know, I went on that thing a couple weeks ago on that panel and this event in Vallejo, and which was really wonderful. And I had my first meeting with somebody who I met there yesterday, which was really wonderful.
Nice.
Bella Hika, who's a actor, YouTuber, now producer, also a writer, although I don't think she really claims that she's much of a writer, but she told me she wrote some stuff, so that's cool. So that was cool. Vallejo resident. So,
what?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if she's going to like my script, but I'm going to send it to her when it's ready and see what she says. There's two other local actors, producers I want to talk to, so I'm trying to hook those meetings up. I also was at a birthday party on Saturday in Albany, which is like, you know, a little bit further from Vallejo, closer to the core of the Bay Area, to Oakland and such. And I met another Vallejo filmmaker at this birthday party randomly. And so then we made friends, and then I'm going to send him my script when it's done for his, honest, critical, feedback, because he's a writer and we don't know each other. And I feel like I really want people to read my script who don't know me. Because I think that it's really helpful to get that perspective from somebody who's like a stranger in my world, you know. Plus, also Vallejo, so very cool. Yeah, and I'm still chipping away at the old script. I didn't actually write last night, which is normally like my guilt time to write right before the show recording. But I wrote twice last week, and I think I'm like I got through all the action, and now I'm like in the like wrap it up stage of the movie where like all the characters move on to the next stages of whatever's going on with them after the bloodbath of the end of the movie. So yeah, it's cool. It's an exciting place. I feel like I just need an hour or 30 minutes and this thing is done. But lately I've been so tired and like last night I was going to write last night. And it's like we watched an episode of Shogun, which is awesome if you haven't seen it. And I was like falling asleep and I was like, it was like 10:40. I was like, I cannot go on. I must go to bed now. It's too much, which is weird for me because usually I'm up to like midnight. But like, you know, last night I was like, this was it. That was it. So yeah, that's what's going on with me. What's going on with you, Liz?
That's just very exciting. I thought I would use this time, the update section of our podcast, to mention that I go on these weekly hikes with Clinton Cornwell, who is friend of the show, Clinton Cornwell, yes. Creative coach. And I was like, Clinton, should I mention these hikes on the podcast? And he's like, we were like on the bubble about whether we should do it. But I'm curious. I think if anyone wants to go on a hike with us, like reach out to the podcast, maybe podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. And I'll forward it to Clinton and we'll let you know where we're meeting. But he basically devised this networking situation where we go on hikes every Sunday at 10 a.m. in Los Angeles, and it's all filmmakers, and we just walk and talk about our work. But I think of it as a threefer, and that's why I go on them, because I prioritize hikes and fitness, you know that. Two, it's networking, and three, it's socializing. It's like, it's threefer. It's so productive, Ulrich. Oh, it is a fourfer, because I get away from my family. It's a fourfer. So it's very, you get a little reprieve. So I wanted to say, like, that's something that's going on right now. And the other thing is, I'm starting to feel human again. And it's been about 7.5 months postpartum, and I'm starting to feel like my body is like healthier. My brain is healthier. Like I'm sleeping a little bit more. Just very grateful to be a little bit more stable lately than I had been feeling. Yeah.
Are you sleeping more? Is that one of the reasons why you're feeling more stable?
I think so. So Gracie's sick right now, but like even with the sickness, she's sleeping in bed with us. She's been sleeping in bed with us for the past few weeks. And I don't know. I know you're not against that, but some people may be against it who are listening. And we have a very specific way she lies and a very specific way I lie. And she's 7.5 months old. And it is literally the only way I've been able to get any sleep. And so we're doing it.
I like to lie on my son when I sleep with him.
Yeah, just sit really on their head. Yeah, exactly.
Just for everyone who's critical, that's the way it works for me. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. Yeah, people will get really up in arms about this whole thing, which is really funny. But I mean, that's how I grew up. I slept in bed with my parents until I was probably like 3 or something, or 2 or something like that. I don't know. It was a long time. It was funny because we didn't do it with BB, and then Beth regretted it. And then now we did it with him, and now we're kind of like at the stage where, you know, like we try to keep him in his crib as much as possible, but there's always at least an hour or so that he ends up with us.
She's with us all night.
He was there. It was basically for the longest time. It was like until the first time he'd wake up at like 3 or so.
Yeah.
He'd be in this crib till 3, and then from 3 onwards, he'd be with us. And like now we're like kind of pulling that back a little bit. And it's like, oh, you know, whenever he wakes up, he like nurses, and then we like actively try to work to get him back into the crib, you know, for the rest of the evening, because we don't want it to be a thing. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's gonna be okay.
Yeah.
In the future, he'll be fine. You know,
they're resilient. And I'm very open to moving her to the crib. We have the crib. It's right behind me. It's great production design for all my Zoom calls.
Beautiful.
But we have not tried to put her in the crib yet. We haven't even experimented. I think I'm so nervous that I'm going to go back to that place of not sleeping, which I was in for like 7 months, 6.5 months, that I don't want to go back there. I want to stay here. Crib,
it'll set you free, you know? That's what I think.
So. I want to be there. I want to be free, Ulrich.
What one last note, we finally took BB out of her crib on Sunday night for the first time. So now she's in a, you know, toddler bed.
Oh, yeah.
And that was great. Like a huge thing. And like, you know, I was like terrified of doing that because I thought that she'd be like, you know, never going to bed and like getting out in the middle of the night and like coming to like watch TV with us or whatever. All these things that I thought would happen and pee the bed or something. I don't know, you know, but like, yeah, I mean, no, she's great. She like went to the bathroom by herself the first night, which was amazing.
And
then, yeah, the next night, there was not a peep from her. And then the morning, first thing, like she just went and used the potty. And I'm like, this is working. It is working.
Well, so. And the only, I like that we have these updates about kids, but the reason I think we bring it up so often is because it's so inextricably linked to our mental health and like whether we can be creative and whether we can be productive on our own projects, right? It's like, I can't even imagine staying up till 10:40. Oh my God, Ulrich, I can't believe you stay up till midnight. Like I can't do that anymore.
That's the only way I can get any writing done is if I like do it like when we're done watching TV or movies or whatever, Beth and I, and it's like I can sneak it in right before bed, you know?
My God.
But like, yeah, or sometimes in the morning. But I mean, and I have been getting up earlier because like I have been going to bed earlier. So I've been getting up earlier and sometimes I can sneak it in the morning, but it's like sometimes he'll wake up and then won't go back to bed. And then Beth needs me to save her, you know, and I feel guilty if I like don't, you know. It can be hard. I think for me, it's like the nights are the best time for writing right now. I just need that 30 minutes to an hour, man. Ooh, so close.
And it's amazing how efficient you can become when you have no time.
You have to be. That's all it is. It's like you can't just sit in front of your desk for 4 hours and be like, okay, what is coming to me writing-wise? It's like you have to, like, I already have the plan. Like, I know what's going to happen in the story. I just have to execute on it now.
Just gotta do it. Well, another thing people need to do, Ulrich, is to support us on Patreon. If you want to. I don't mean to be a mandate. It's not a mandate. If you want to, support us on Patreon. Patreon.com/MMIH podcast. It is how we are keeping the show running. Every single dollar counts. Thank you so much. But without any more delay, here is Ulrich's chat with Kate, Christopher, and Neil.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Neil, Kate, and Chris, the team behind Ren, the Girl with the Mark. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hello.
Thank you.
So let's just, before we get into the actual questions, let's just go one by one. And if you could just introduce yourselves and tell us what your role is on the show.
Silence.
Okay. Go on, Kate.
No one knows ever who to go first. Well, hello. I'm Kate Madison. I helped create the show to begin with, along with Chris. I was like showrunner and director of the first season, and I directed the first episode of the second season.
Well, I can follow up on that. I'm Chris, co-creator of the show with Kate, that we did many years ago. It's quite a journey. Many hats during season one, and I directed episode two of season two.
And I'm Neil. I was the director of photography on season one, and I'm now the showrunner and still the director of photography.
Awesome. One of you, or a collection of you, can you guys give us the elevator pitch for the show and then for also for season two?
Well, we can sort of start about... I'll start off setting the world, I think. So we're in a fantasy world. It's called Alathia. It's a country that was united by a North King about 1,000 years ago or something, and the North Kings ruled this place for a long, long, long time. And then, was it the 16th North King or something like that, was killed in a rebellion along with his wife and two kids. So there was no heir to the throne. And in order to defeat this rebellion, a faction called the Kanath kind of rose to the challenge, and they managed to quell this rebellion. But after that, they sort of realized that in order to keep hold of power, because power is that sort of thing that when you have it, you don't want to let go. They sort of felt that they had to get rid of their opposition, even though that opposition was actually helping them quell the rebellion. So it became quite a totalitarian place. And the blame for most of the things that happened in the past was sort of laid on a group of people called the Numari, or the Mari spirit. And people who had the spirit was called the Numari. And when we start season one, we're in this kind of world where the Numari are now called the Marked Ones, and they are seen as evil people. And so, yeah, that's the start of season one, where we meet Ren, who's the lead character in the show. And she's grown up in this place where these marked people are pure evil, or considered pure evil, even though back in the day they were actually quite good people. One day she meets some rebels, maybe some thieves out in the forest. They have this container that has a spirit. It breaks, and Ren is possessed by the spirit. She gets the mark. And obviously that's a very bad thing. Mm. So yeah, she's becoming a marked one. She's put on trial. She's chased out of the village. And that's where season one ends, with the da-da-da to be continued. Over to someone to pick up on season two.
Well, I think that's a pretty good setup. And so season two finds them on the run, Ren and Hunter, who was one of the thieves that stole the container with the spirit in. Yeah, they're on the run from the Kanath, and Ren's trying to figure out what the spirit is, what it means, what powers it gives her, and most importantly, is it good or evil, and is there a way to get it out of her? And Hunter might know someone that can help with that, and it's kind of a road movie or a quest narrative in season two of getting to that person.
Awesome. And then how many days did you shoot season two?
Season two was shot for 24 or 25 days, I believe. So for a season that's about I think it's 64 minutes total running time.
Wow.
It was kind of like a little bit over a week per episode, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
What was the rough budget of the show, if you can say? I think you can say, because you talk about it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe season one was something like £36,000. Season two was a little bit less. So I guess that's in the high sort of $28,000. I'm converting the wrong way. Low 40 thousands of dollars.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Where did this come from? I know this is a book that you based the show on, but whose idea was it to make this thing? Where did this whole thing start?
I mean, it isn't based on a book.
Oh, it's not? Okay.
No, we probably should write it as a book, because I'm sure it would get more interest. No, it just started as an idea of wanting to make a original fantasy production, a sort of series-style production, because the original idea was to essentially make a collection of short films that all told a sort of continuous story rather than just standalone short films. But then we sort of, it grew into something that was not easy to shoot as little like Weekenders sort of thing. But that was the original idea. And it just came a little bit from playing video games and watching other people playing video games, and mostly sort of the character creation of video games, and how tattoos and facial markings was a big thing, or is a big thing in all fantasy gameplay and things like that. And yet it's not really, you don't often see it in the fantasy film so much, or I didn't at the time. And I was sort of musing on this and then going, yeah, because like the facial sort of markings in these games is like cool and everyone wants one. What if we flipped that and it's not cool and nobody wants it? And then sort of taking that kind of idea and the ideas of symbiotic relationships of people with other creatures and other beings inside them. And that is essentially that the spirit combines with the host, causing the marks and adding extra layers. Basically, it's all about them bringing the sort of the knowledge and essence of the people before. And so that as the spirit moves between hosts, it sort of like collects the essence of that person and the memories of that person and gives it to the sort of next host. So each host kind of learns the knowledge of the previous people. So the Numari, at least in the past, and maybe not with Ren's world right now, is that they are knowledgeable and wise and sort of like almost teachers in the world, because they have this ancestral knowledge that isn't just sort of passed down. It literally is passed down through the spirit. So they gain all this knowledge. So that's sort of the essence of where it came from. And then it was like, what if we just throw it on some young girl in the middle of provincial, you know, village and go deal with that? It's not good anymore. Like, find out the history of it essentially, and grow, and this coming of age story for this young woman, basically.
Awesome. You said that it was kind of inspired by video games that you were playing at the time. Can you name some of the games that were an inspiration?
I think, I mean, like, I don't know if like I would say the inspiration from the video games is specific to the show, although lots of fantasy has very similar elements and we definitely play with a lot of those. I think it happened to be like Skyrim that I was playing around in the character creation. I don't think I've really actually played much of Skyrim, but I've definitely played around in the character creation. But even games, you know, games that are released now, like Baldur's Gate, you've got incredible sort of like facial markings that you can put on and tattoos and but you can change the colors and they can look sort of organic. And that was always the idea with Ren, that this marking was very sort of organic. It was also inspired quite a lot by Dax from Star Trek. And so that sort of symbiotic leaves a mark kind of idea, really.
Amazing. I have a lot of questions. I'm going to save them for later. I'll just keep going on my standard questions. So how long did you spend on working on season two from when you wrote it and started shooting to it being released?
Well, the writing was sort of spread out over a long period, because I think Kate started some of season two not long after season one was finished. And then in 2019, Kate and I and two other writers, Ash Finn and Ash Maharaj, did a lot of work on it, tried to get season two off the ground in early 2020. COVID happened, various other things. So it wasn't really until the end of 2022 that it really started happening, when I got Kate and Chris's permission to take the series on and seriously started pre-producing it. And then I guess maybe sort of for five months of pre-production, the month of shooting, and then what was something like nine months in post-production.
Wow. And then just for clarity, so Kate and Chris, were you involved with all of season two, or did you just come in to shoot parts of it? Or were you there every day with Neil getting season two made?
I sort of more or less just got on board with episode two and worked with Neil on that one. And those were sort of my allocated days to come in and direct, and then took over from someone else, from Kate, and then handed over to Johnny, who's the director for the third episode. A limited time for me, but Kate is closer to physically.
Literally roommates, yes. So it's a little easier.
You might have had a bit more involvement in that.
It's been mixed. I mean, no way the involvement that I did in season one, because I was very much sort of like doing Neil's job then. And I basically was mostly just a director. I sort of like gave some advice and various things, and I helped out with writing. I've been there to be able to sort of watch the odd edit and various things, but I very much stepped back from everything for season two, partly because I needed that separation, that break myself. So having Neil sort of take the reins was quite a nice thing. And then being able to just sort of come in with a lot less stress and a lot less worry about things, coming in just to sort of direct and focus on one part was actually really nice and re-sparked that excitement for the project and everything. But really, Neil is the one who's been pushing this production completely, building the team and various things. I managed to bring back a lot of people from the first season, which is great considering how long it'd been since then. Wow. So.
Yeah. And then last question for all of you. If there's one thing you could change about the show, this could be season one or season two, and it could be in any way. Like, it could be process. It could be a day of shooting. It could be something that's in the final edit, anything. What would that thing be?
Mm. For me, it would be that we could have gone straight into season two after season one. That would have been perfect, but loads of reasons why we couldn't.
Yeah, as I'm now preparing to go straight into season three, I'm very aware of those reasons. I think for me, there's one location in season two that we never quite found, and we ended up sort of mocking up in a different place and using some visual effects for the establishing shot. And I think it works, but it wasn't what I'd imagined.
Mm. I think we're thinking of the same thing.
Probably.
I mean, there's so much potential that you could sort of go, oh, you know, if we just had a bit more time, if we just had a bit more this money, if we could just did this. I think for me, there's a little bit similar, maybe, that being, especially as I was the first director on the first week of the, you know, of sort of restarting this whole thing, there's, I think, yeah, having more potential of better locations. Like, the team is amazing at making things work, and we had this wonderful farm that we filmed so much on, and we made it work really well. But I would have loved, I get jealous of some of the other episodes where they've got these wonderful, like, locations, and I'm like, we shot everything on the farm pretty much. Like, I wish we could have, like, shown a little bit more interest location-wise.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, and I think it's potentially a similar scene in the first episode where it works, but it's not perfect. It could have been much nicer, but, you know, time and budget and all that, it's tough.
It's the limitation of filmmaking on a budget, that you kind of, when you write stuff, you can write whatever you want. You can have 100 horses attacking, you can have thousands of orcs or whatever. And then it comes down to, right, we got $5. You know, what can we do? And you just got to make it work. But I think the flip of that coin is that you have to be creative all the time. And sometimes when you watch big budget films, they have amazing locations and stuff like that, but they don't actually make the best of it because they sort of take it for granted. And sometimes when you're faced with, well, we have to make this work somehow, you get a bit more creative. And sometimes the result is actually better maybe than you could have done.
Yeah. But I always feel like having restrictions, you know, kind of forces you to be more creative. And like maybe something will be better than it could have been if you didn't have those restrictions, you know.
Mm.
So I kind of have a big overarching question for you guys. I mean, this is like, if season one, I mean, there's no argument. Like, this was a hit, right? Like, you had millions of people watch your show. It did pretty much as you could probably hope to imagine making a web series. What was that like for you guys? And what did that mean for you as artists after season one was done?
Well, first of all, it was sort of incredible because you're working on something for quite a number of years, and you make it and, you know, the dust settles and you put it out in the world and you don't know what people are going to say, how they're going to react. And the reaction was incredible. I think, and Kate, you can correct me, but we sort of won 15 international web series awards and stuff.
That's a good question. I mean, a bunch of them are on here. They're a bit
14, I believe.
Let's count them.
More than 40 nominations.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah, and that was the thing, and it took Kate to, I mean, we went to Los Angeles for an awards stuff. You went to Australia.
I did a round the world trip.
Yeah.
Essentially, I literally went all the way around. But yes, went out to America and Melbourne. And I mean, so many, like Bilbao, like we traveled to quite a few because it was, and Seoul, I went to, Korea. Because it was such an amazing opportunity to visit places I'd probably never think about visiting and to represent the show. And it's so nice to sort of like be there and sort of see, like, and then you walk away with an award and you're like, wow, that's amazing. That's so cool. So yes, definitely a nice ego boost for that sort of thing. It's kind of crazy that the sort of response, and I can't remember, like, because I'm thinking about it now. Actually, I could probably look back on the YouTube channel and maybe Neil has done this, but like on, because you get that sort of same pressure now to go, well the next season needs to hit millions of views. And I'm sure Neil is
I have looked at that. Yeah.
I'm curious about it because I was thinking about this of like, how quickly did it hit that those sort of figures and things, and maybe Neil can say.
Yeah, season one, episode one took about 2 years to get to 1 million views.
Yeah, okay.
It did well when it came out, but about 12 to 18 months after we released it, something happened. It may be to do with Sophie Skelton, who was the lead in season one, and her appearing in a show called Outlander. It may have been because YouTube changed its algorithm in our favor or something. We don't exactly know.
It recommended,
about 18 months after it was released, the views suddenly sort of started to accelerate.
It is possible that's an Outlander thing. I think we were very lucky. We were both lucky and unlucky that Sophie got cast in Outlander because it took away our lead actress, which was one of the main reasons why we didn't just keep going with the show instantly. But it also gave us a boost to people watching it. So it was a double-edged sword. And yeah, and that's a sort of an interesting thing. But yeah, it was interesting to sort of see how it went. I know that it for Chris and I at the time, like, we were seeing if it would generate sort of interest abroad, and we did talk to an agent in the US and thinking that they were going to be pitching it around, which in theory they did, but it didn't, you know. So you have all this sort of thing, you think, oh, this is going to be amazing. It's got, you know, however many million views. I mean, it's now got about 8 or 9 million views on the first episode, which is still just crazy.
And incredible.
Yeah. But the reality of that doesn't, it, like, people aren't calling you and constantly going, wow, we should pitch this to Netflix. It's amazing. You know, like, it, even though all the comments say this should be there, and quality-wise, we think, yeah, this is pretty damn good. We've seen some Netflix shows that aren't as good, in our opinion. But yeah, it's surprising that even though you've got millions of views, it doesn't sort of necessarily equate to suddenly sort of like fame and fortune, if that's what anyone was wanting.
There is still like quite a distance from YouTube channels and online content stuff into the, I don't want to say real world, because it is the real world as well, but into bigger productions. It's so much money. There's so many people trying to get into that. So, yeah, even though a lot of people say, oh, my God, you should go and pitch and go to LA and stuff like that, it's quite a leap to try and do that. And as Kate said, we did go to LA. We did have some meetings with people from very big agencies in LA who were sort of, well, first, I don't know if you remember, Kit, but we had a meeting with one guy, and he was like, I saw the first episode, and I was like, there's no way this is an online thing. This must have been on a network somewhere. They're trying to kid me. It's a joke. What's going on? So we knew that we had something that has that quality and looks the part. But yeah, it's still a long, 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 long way from doing something like that into a big Netflix production or network production.
Mm-hmm. And we do still find, actually, that many of our viewers on YouTube don't quite understand that we made it. They think we've just pirated some TV show and put it up there. You know, they're commenting, where do we watch full episodes? These are the full episodes.
Yeah, it's hilarious. So with the success of season one, was it easy to raise the budget for season two, or was it like, just as challenging to get the money for the first second season as it was for the first season? Or did it kind of make it easier?
No, it was still very challenging. I mean, we tried in early 2020, just before COVID hit, we tried to do a Kickstarter to take the whole thing up a level in terms of budget and to be able to pay people at least a sort of, you know, token amount, you know, which kind of added an extra zero to the end of the budget. And we did pretty well, all things considered. I mean, you know, I think we had sort of £50,000 worth of pledges, but we didn't reach the target that we were going for. And then, you know, it probably is for the best with then all the lockdowns happening straight afterwards that didn't succeed anyway. So no, I mean, we're now funded through Patreon, and, you know, we're sort of pushing that hard at the moment as we release season two. And we have an amazing sort of core of fans who are really, really supportive and, yeah, really follow us and give their money and, you know, are really sort of into everything we do. But it's still a struggle.
One thing I think we've found, like, because obviously, yeah, if we had launched straight into a Kickstarter after season one, we might well have, you know, gotten the money again and all this sort of stuff. But that time in between did lose us some momentum, essentially. Even though the views were still going up, we sort of lost some of that. And then we tried to sort of build it up for that Kickstarter. But even then, I remember doing a survey. I basically, like, sent out to our mailing list and things and was like, you know, asking various questions, quite literally things like, you know, are you willing to pay for it? Or do you want to watch it but not pay for it? All this sort of stuff. And was quite shocked a lot by people who are like, I want to watch it, but I don't want to pay for it. And all this sort of stuff that showed that we didn't really have the backing that we wanted or needed. And around that, I feel like as well, that was sort of around the time it was building up to more and more things like Netflix and places where you could pay a monthly subscription and get like stupid amounts of content. And so putting the same sort of money or potentially more, like, you know, a tenner towards a Kickstarter project that's a bit more like, will it work? Will it happen? Will it not? You get one show that's like a few 10-minute episodes, you know, whereas you could put that same money towards Netflix and just see loads of stuff. Even if you really like Ren, it's a lot to ask from people. And where it seems to work is when there's a following that is where you're producing a stupid amount of content, like YouTubers who are putting out things like weekly or even three times a week, they're able to maybe do a Kickstarter for a bigger project because they've got that audience constantly there. But because of the amount of work it takes to put together something like Ren, and we don't have the ability to just be pumping out content all the time, it really makes it a struggle because you're only putting out like an hour every however many years, and it just doesn't quite generate that same enthusiasm. So yeah, it just makes it very tough. But hopefully Neil's trying to keep that momentum going. They're releasing a lot of content on the Patreon, and we'll sort of see how it goes. But it is a constant sort of struggle, and we'll see.
Yeah. So is the show 100% funded by Patreon now, or do you have other funders in addition to that?
I do subsidize it a bit, yeah, at the moment. But I hope to get it to the point where the Patreon will fully fund it. Yeah.
That's awesome. So is the idea that becomes a sustainable model for making the show, that like the Patreon folks just end up funding season three, season four, season five? And like, can you keep up the model that you have, or do you need to increase budget in order to start paying people more or to support what you're doing out, you know, when you make the show?
I mean, my feeling is that it will always be made on this level, that it will always be a volunteer cast and crew. And, you know, I did ask myself, you know, seriously about that before I took it on. And, you know, can you keep asking people to do stuff unpaid? And, you know, there's various arguments for and against unpaid work generally and in the film and TV industry. But I think, you know, the way I look at it is I've done loads and loads of unpaid work myself as a DP on other projects. So I feel like I've paid my dues there. And, I've, you know, it's an industry that loads and loads of people want to work in, and there just aren't enough jobs for them. It's certainly not in the UK. The number of people that want to be in the industry versus the number of jobs the industry will support. So I think, I think it's a good thing to give people that otherwise might not get to work on a film or a TV show an opportunity to do that kind of thing and to work on a fantasy project, which everyone, you know, everyone loves that element to it. And the atmosphere that we have on set is just amazing. The sort of the family feeling that we have, the way the cast and crew bond, you know, some of the feedback I've had at the wrap party, and I know these guys had it at the season one and it happened again on season two, is just, you know, just people say lovely things. It's been the highlight of their career. They you know, they've made new friends. It's been life-changing for them. And yeah, I don't think it would be quite the same if it was a paid project. You know, I mean, all for, obviously, you know, our industry needs paid projects to exist, and long may that continue. But for this project, no, I always see it being on that level and funded by the fans. And I think it's a special project for that. And yeah, it's harder to make it, but it's worth it, I think.
It's just an amazing thing because, you know, I've done free work too for projects, and I've had people work on my projects for free in volunteer work, you know, and it's like you said, like something that you always grapple with, like what is right and what's fair. But I've always thought about it as like if you're very clear with your team and like you're not getting paid yourself, right? You're also volunteering your time. It's like, you know, it's an opportunity, like you said, like for the right person, it could be a really great experience, you know. But I guess the other question that I wanted to follow up, Neil, is like, do you see yourself doing this for season 3, 4, 5, 6? Or is there a time limit where you feel like you're going to have to hand off the torch to someone else and move on to another project?
I wouldn't rule that out. I mean, if someone came along that was willing to take it on, I mean, obviously that's not really my decision. That would be up to, you know, Kate and Chris have trusted me to do it this far. If I ever did step back, I guess it would be up to them to see if they wanted to trust someone else to do it. But no, certainly I'm doing season 3, and I have a lot of ideas about where the story can go in multiple seasons after that. So we will see. But for now, I'm loving doing it, and long may it continue.
Amazing. So like, I guess it sounds like the hope isn't to make it into like an hour long or 30 minute long show, that you're thinking that it's just, this is what it's going to live as forever. Mm-hmm. But is there any, like, do you still have ambitions for that at some point? Or is it kind of like after your experience going to Los Angeles and meeting with everybody, it's like, no, this is what it is. And that's a beautiful thing.
It obviously is a beautiful thing that it's continued, because I think both myself and Kate had kind of gone, well, that was cool. It was great to do the show, but so many years have passed and it's probably never going to be picked up. We've done a few ideas. There's a feature script. There's some writings behind, you know, some backstory writings and stuff like that. But that was kind of where it sort of ended until Neil turned up with his crazy idea of picking it up, which was amazing. But I think for all of us, if someone came along and said, look, I've got these people who want to invest in it and make it a bigger thing, where you potentially could start working with as many people that has worked on the show as possible, but maybe start paying these people and stuff. That would be amazing if it could go that way. But it's not something I think we will count on, or that's not the point of it. If that happens, that would be a lovely thing. But so far, it's all, well, the two seasons and season 3 as well is going to be made the way the other two seasons have been made. And I think, as Neil said, you know, it's great that a lot of people are returning to the show after, like, what was it, 8 years since we filmed the first season. And there are loads of people, actors, but also creators behind the scenes, prop makers, all sorts of people who sort of jumped at the opportunity to do it again, which is, I think, is just amazing.
Here's a kind of a more of a process question, but how did you form the team for the show in the beginning? Like, you know, making a show for $40,000, £35,000, whatever, that's like a show like this. It's like incredible. Like, you know, it's hard to imagine that you actually did it. But so how did you find the people who are willing to collaborate with you to make it happen? And then also, just curious, like, what was the size of your crew? Is it like, are you talking 20 people, 30 people, 40 people? Like, what did it take to make the show?
Gosh. So, I mean, it very much started with the idea. And then I think I pitched the very original idea to Chris, and then Chris and I basically bounced back and forth writing stuff. And And really, like, we didn't have, I don't think, anything else in place before we did our Kickstarter. We just went, want to do this, can't, like, we have nothing but our word. And we had, I mean, we had one thing, which was I'd made a Lord of the Rings fan film called Born of Hope that Chris had starred in, helped write and various things, and helped with editing. And so we had done that, and that had done very well. And so we kind of had at least that that small thing that said, we can make a fantasy thing. We can put something online that will appeal to people, and we can do fantasy. But really, other than that, it was very much a leap of faith, both for us, I suppose, but mostly for people backing us. And the Kickstarter was tough. Like, we weren't asking for huge amounts of money considering what we were trying to accomplish. And we it was to the wire in the end of actually, like, succeeding. And then it was very much like, okay, now we need to, like, gather this crew. And we had various people we'd worked with before. And then, so sort of like basically just putting out the feelers. We sort of talked with various filmmakers that we knew, and they put out their feelers, and we advertised. And there was, so it was a lot of luck, to be honest, I think, that we gathered together a team that was so committed and understood the brief, in the sense of, like, we aim up here, like, there's no that'll do kind of element to it. I think I would only say that we maybe had one person who joined who kind of had a that'll do attitude, and they didn't kind of last because it didn't sort of work. They weren't interested. And I think that's the thing as well about an unpaid project, is that, as Neil said, it's, I would love to be able to pay people, but I also love the enthusiasm you get from an unpaid project, because if someone doesn't want to do it, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it for the paycheck and then just turn up begrudgingly every day and do just the bare minimum to make it work. Like, they want to be there, and they want it to look cool, and they want it to look the best it can be. And my attitude has always been, filmmaking is hard. So why, like, and no matter whether it, you produce something good or something meh, you know, it's hard work. I mean, this is the whole point of this podcast, but it's really tough to put it together and make something. And so if you're going to do it, do the best you can possibly do, so that at the end of the day, you're proud of what you've just spent months doing, instead of something you're like, ugh, I just wasted my time doing that. Why did I even do that? And so I think a lot of people sort of, like, understood that, or at least once they got involved, understood that. And we had people that would come along, like Ash, who is now part of the writing team and was part of the art department and stuff. They came on board as, I think we advertised for extras, for supporting artists, and we put out through some of these reenactment groups, I think, because we'd had some amazing reenactors, some Viking reenactors work on Born of Hope, and they were just the best. They turn up in their own costumes. They were really loyal. They were really enthusiastic. And so we did a similar thing for Ren, and Ash and their sister got involved, and then they never left. Like, they came and they were on set, and then they were like, things need doing. There's props that need, like, making or fixing on things. And they just got involved. And that's what we sort of found. We kind of had, I don't know if it was a mantra of a saying that if people turned up, they might never leave in a good way. Like, we trapped them in with the excitement of making this project. And so having the warehouse that we had in season one and having the farm in season two really makes a difference, because people could turn up and just help out on a weekend. Like, we had creative weekends or workshop weekends. Can't remember what we called them.
Making weekends. That's really key to the success of both seasons of Ren, I think, is having a studio space. Yeah, which was, for season one, was a disused factory. Now it's a farm, we use the grain store and the barn next to it. And yeah, we have the space for a couple of months before we shoot, and people can come along, and we literally throw it open to anyone to come along at the weekends and help hammer something together, sew a costume, paint something, make a prop, bring your kids. They can make things out of, you know, sort of Play-Doh and flour and stuff, you know, for background props. And yeah, that's all adds to the community feel of it.
What's that famous thing, you build it and they'll come, or something like that?
Yeah,
it's almost like that. And I think Kate, when she did Born of Hope, that's the first time sort of experienced that, you know, you're putting something out there, you're showing some pictures of stuff and people will start turning up. And for Ren, again, you start posting stuff and showing what you're doing. And there were people flying in from the States, from the Netherlands, you know, people just turning up because they wanted to be there.
Yeah.
As Kate said, if you do something and you yourself at the top of the pyramid show your commitment that you are there. I mean, we were there 24/7 building sets and stuff like that. And if you leave from that perspective, people turn up and go, oh, I was expecting, you know, a few little bits of wood, you know, painted, but actually there's an entire village. And people go, oh, okay. And it ups their game. And I think that's the key to it. And what Neil did with season two, that, you know, there was some really good locations. You show people that, oh, we're going to these places, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And people go, well, if you're good in doing that, then I'm in.
That's amazing. It sounds like such a magical experience. Like you talk about bringing families out on the weekends to help build stuff. It just really sounds like a really amazing setup. Okay, it's time for our final questions. I'm a little short on time. I have a meeting I have to be at 11, but we'll get through these. So each of you should answer. I'll just, to make it easy, I'll start with you, Chris.
Okay.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Best filmmaking advice is be on time. Just be on time. You know, filmmaking is such a collaborative thing. There's so many people involved. And if you are not there, you stop everything. You're wasting everybody's time. So turn up on time.
Okay, Kate, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm giggling at that because I'm the worst for timekeeping.
It wasn't a dig at you.
No, I know. It's just quite funny. But yes, I am not the best at timekeeping. So I don't know if I ever got this from anyone else, but I think it's good advice to pass on. So apologies if I'm forgetting something very useful someone else told me. But the thing that I've found the most useful in what I've done is something that I say is, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I don't know if it came from anywhere, but I basically just discovered it as I was doing projects, because I found with the big projects that I've done, like Born of Hope and Ren season one and things like that, is that just asking does you no harm whatsoever. Like asking someone, if you're admiring some location or a prop or someone's, you know, you're looking at some Etsy page and they make amazing armor and you'd like love to use it or whatever. If you don't just ask them, like, they'll never be able to say yes or no. Like, the worst that can happen is they say no. But like, we managed to get the amazing Norton Armories involved in Born of Hope, and then they came on board with Ren as well. Raven Armories also, who make these fantastic, beautiful, almost artwork swords. Got involved with them, talked to them, did deals where, you know, we for Born of Hope, but we've used a lot of them in later things where, yeah, just admired something and decided to ask. And the same really is true for the locations as well. It's like knowing that having a location to work in, like even if it's a big warehouse or a big barn, like having something like that, a space to work, is for, at least for me, I don't know if it's general for lots of people, but I find it much easier to have a space. And so many creative projects that I've done have worked because I had a space at the time. And it's much harder when you don't have that space to work in. So yeah.
I think these weren't to be short answers.
I'm sorry. Don't ask, don't get. So go ask.
Beautiful.
Neil, you might be able to get 10 seconds in.
So mine would be, someone once said to me, your rushes are the worst your film is ever going to be. And I think that's a great thing to remember, because in pre-production, the film only exists in your head and it's perfect. And of course, your rushes never are perfect and it can be quite depressing. But just remember, you've got this entire post-production process that will only make the film or the series better and better and better through all the various editing and pickups and coloring and sound design.
Okay, next question. What's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Oh, the worst. Oh, does someone else want to go? I can't think of one off the top of my head.
I'm trying to think generally of advice I've been given. I'm trying to think of like what people have told me that I think is good or bad. But again, I don't know if this is advice, but I would just say, don't limit your potential, basically. So if you have grandiose ideas and things, that's fine. Like, the way I have always approached it is I aim up here and then I'll pull down until I can do it, rather than going, oh, well, I can't possibly do what I'd like to do, so I'll just do this, that sort of thing. Or even focusing down in a story. If you have a grand idea, focus down into the characters, the small amount of characters. You can tell an amazingly huge story just through two people in a room, even if the setting could be huge. Like, so again, I don't, that's more advice. But you know, that's useful.
Probably
for people,
so. Probably the worst thing that can be said in filmmaking is fix it in post.
Oh, yeah.
Because if it's not there, it's not there, you know. So if someone says, oh, it's all right, we'll fix it in post, and like, no.
Yep.
All right, Neil, you got
we'll
one.
Had to do it, but
oh god, I mean, I think just, you know, there are always some people, when you go into the film industry, there are always going to be some people that will go, oh, you know, you'll never succeed. It's too competitive. You know, the freelancing is too risky. And what if you don't get work and all that kind of stuff? And I think you just got to not listen to those naysayers. You know, you've got to believe in your heart that this is what you want to do, and you've got to take the leap and go for it.
Awesome. And then last question, is making movies hard?
Yes.
That's a nice, yes. Easy question. Yes. Yes, it's hard, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
Last thing I want to say is, I just looked up Born of Hope, 49 million views. Holy crap. That's amazing.
Yeah, there's like two versions out there. So there's more. There's a higher one as well.
I mean, I've had a few people on the show who've had a lot of views on various different music videos and stuff. But I mean, 49 million plus on one project. That's incredible. So congratulations.
Yeah, I wish I had a penny for every view. That would be really nice.
I think it should be in the Guinness Book of Record. I think it must be the fan film with the most views ever.
I don't know. I haven't looked that up.
You look at some of the Star Wars things that are extremely popular, but they're not anywhere near that.
I still don't really understand it, to be honest. I know you've got to go, but it's always interesting that, considering its title is literally Born of Hope and it has no reference to Lord of the Rings whatsoever, it still does so well. So thank you, YouTube, for your random random recommendations and whatever else you do, because it's appreciated.
All right, last thing before I go, shout out the show. What should people do if they watch season one and they don't know where season two is, or if they're just hearing about this for the first time and they want to watch the show? What should they do? Should they watch every episode from the beginning, or, you know, is there a certain episode they should jump into? Like, what do you want people to do?
Watch it from the beginning. You know, the episodes are only 10 or 15 minutes. It won't take you long to catch up. And that's the best way to get into the story. And you can just find it on YouTube, Ren, R-E-N, the girl with the mark.
And then shout out your Patreon page. If they want to support, what should they do?
Yeah, that's patreon.com/Ren, the girl with the mark. Again, Ren's just R-E-N. That is a great way to support us. It'll enable us to do season three and beyond, and you get bonus content, short stories from the worlds of Ren, audio books, early access to episodes, ad-free downloads, merch. There's loads of stuff on there.
Well, last thing I'll say is, it blows my mind that this team with millions and millions and millions of viewers of your work has not been snapped up by some kind of production company or studio or something. It seems like a damn shame. Somebody should listen and pay attention. These guys know what they're fucking doing.
Arik, tell us one thing that you remember about your chat with Kate, Christopher, and Neil.
Well, a few things, but I'll just try to keep it to two. So one was that, you know, they did this web series basically first in 2016. You know, they did it as like a no budget, low budget project where like everybody was volunteers and working for free, and like, you know, all the money went to props and to like tangible stuff that they couldn't get, you know, for free. You know, they weren't sure if they were going to be able to do that again, and they were like hoping that they were going to be able to like get a bigger budget for the next one. And they even had meetings in Los Angeles and all that stuff, because they got millions and millions upon millions of views on the first season. Like something like it's like 9 million views on episode one now, and like each other episode has like over a million views. So it's like pretty nuts. And they didn't get any deal. The LA meetings didn't work out. Nothing came from it, you know, which is like too bad. So they just decided to do it again. And Neil basically was the one who like revived the show. He's like, I want to be the showrunner. I want to do season two. Let's go. Let's do it. And then they basically ended up raising another $40,000 or so US through Patreon. And like that's what they got from the second show. Yes, exactly. So it does work, Liz. It does work. But then basically, you know, they had to do it the same way again. And they're like wondering, like, is it like something that they can do like sustainably? Like, is it fair to ask people to work for free? And it was basically this conversation about like, you know, if it's presented the right way and it's like an opportunity for people to make something and where they wouldn't have the opportunity to work on something otherwise, like if that wouldn't exist, like there is no fantasy show that this up and coming person can like grind their teeth on, like building props or making swords or shields or whatever. Like, you know, it's kind of like a really great opportunity in that way. And then they described like how they would do their prep for the show. And it would be like every weekend people would come out to like in the first season, I guess they had this huge warehouse that they had donated to them for months. And then in the second one, they had a big farm that was donated to them for months. And so they would just have people come out with their families on the weekend and build props and sew this thing. And like, it's like kids and, you know, here, take this and build this thing, you know, little kid or whatever. It's like a family, wonderful bonding experience. And like, it just sounded really beautiful that they did that. You know, it's like they're basically providing kind of like a, like some sort of craft service or like filmmaking, you know, camp to a degree, you know? And if you look at it in that way, it's like, I feel like it's a really beautiful thing. And it's like, is a sustainable thing that you can keep on doing as long as you've got people like Neil and, you know, who's willing to like donate, you know, hours upon hours of his time to like, you know, run the show and like write the show and organize the whole thing, you know, because it's like a crazy endeavor. The other thing I wanted to say is that so Kate did a Lord of the Rings fan film before this. That was like her first thing. Guess how many millions of views that thing has?
Oh, God. Like 10, 15. I mean, go on.
49 million.
Oh, my God.
49
People
million
really
views.
Like that stuff. I mean, I like that stuff.
And it's not even branded Lord of the Rings. It just says it's like Born to Run or Born to whatever. It's like, you know, it just has its name of its movie. And it just happens to be a Lord of the Rings thing. And people find it, love it, watch it. And it's just nuts. And it's like, you know, this woman, between her work on Ren and her show, she's got like 65 million, 70 million views of her work. And she's not getting hired to direct stuff. It's like, what is going on in this world? Like, I mean, it just seems bizarre to me that, like, you know, she's clearly has the ability to make something that an audience wants. Right. And then, like, people are not seeing that as like, yes, hire this woman. She will do that for you too.
Never trust gatekeepers to use their imagination. It's cool.
And then just one last little bit of tirade here. Like, you know, you'll see like show, like those short films will like, you know, go viral with like 4 million views. And then, you know, it'll be used to like create a bidding war of this script or whatever. Like I saw this, I can't remember the name of it, but it happened like 8 years ago or something. And it was all like orchestrated because it was like this person already had management. They had a deal with this company and then they do the whole thing. And it's like, oh, yes, viral, millions of views. You have to. That is why you must pay money for this thing. And it's like, well, look, dog, like this person over here has 50 million views on her thing. And you don't care. It's like, oh, it's all a game. It's all who you know. It's all this bullshit. It just makes me like feel like, oh, yeah, whatever. It's all the connections. It doesn't actually matter about the audience.
Yeah.
It's like, the connections is what really
matters.
But
if she had a way of like extracting information about that audience so that they were tied to her permanently, like email addresses, just not to harp on about email addresses, but if she had half the email addresses of the people who watched that short film, or sorry, that Lord of the Rings film, she'd be in a fantastic place right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's how they built their Patreon is through email addresses from the viewers of the shows.
Good job, Kate.
But I think it is really hard to, like, you know, turn those views into fans. And I guess another thing they talked about was, like, they emailed a bunch of their subscribers and they were like, you know, hey, like, would you pay for this show to watch it, you know? And like half of them said no. Like, I'd watch it for free, but I wouldn't
pay for it.
But
half of them said yes. Half said yes.
Exactly. And that's the budget. And that's where the budget comes from. So anyways, very interesting stuff. But we got to get to the question of the week for Ask the Expert. Ask the Expert is It's a segment that our producer, Eric Toms, came up with, where he comes up with a question that we should be the absolute experts in and asks us this question. And we get to read these ahead of time, so we get to think about our answers. So here is this week's Ask the Expert question. Every one of my friends are filmmakers. Yes. And I'm constantly being bombarded with donation requests from Seed and Spark, Kickstarter, and a number of other sites. What are some ways I can support my indie filmmaker friends without spending money? Liz, what do you say to this?
I'm clapping back. I'm say you spend the money. You give them the money to their crowdfunding campaigns. And here's why. I don't give a ton of money to crowdfunding campaigns. I would say the most I've ever given is like $35. Usually, I know you and I have talked about it differently. And I think you give like, you're a little bit more generous than I am. But my perspective
is... Not much.
Okay, sorry, not to call you out. People should not be expecting millions of dollars from Ulrich. But I'm just saying that like $35 to me is a really meaningful amount of money, but it should be really meaningful to them. And it helps them get their project off the ground and helps them make their numbers move. And it's like the cost of a birthday present. So if these are your friends and you want to give them a birthday present, which birthday presents don't exist as adults. We never give each other birthday presents. So I'm just saying, think of it as a birthday present and give them $5. And that's way less than you would spend on a birthday present. I think what the answer that I should be saying is like rent their movie on iTunes and watch their movie on AVOD and support indie filmmakers by watching their content. But I don't have 2 hours. I can't watch someone's movie. I can make their day by giving them a little bit of money to their Kickstarter, Seed and Spark, Indiegogo, whatever it is. So, Eric, all of your friends are filmmakers. That's awesome. Give them money to make their projects happen. I'm also maybe saying this because I will be running a crowdfunding campaign in a few weeks. So that's possibly the reason why I feel this way. Ulrich, what about you?
Well, I would say that when I was running my crowdfunding campaigns, like even a dollar would feel good. Like anytime anyone would donate anything, you felt like a win. So I do agree that like, yeah, if you can't give $100, $50, whatever, like $20, $25, $30. Like
so generous.
Like if you get like 100 people to give you $20.
Benny's got opinions about
Benny,
this.
He has too
Benny
many
wants
opinions.
To share.
Yeah, if you get like 100 people to give you $20, that's $2,000, you know? So like that makes that's, you know, it's not like,
huge deal.
You know, it's not going to fund your movie, but like that's going to be a nice big chunk towards your $20,000 goal, $15,000 goal, whatever it is, you know? So yeah, no, I say do it. But then I say if you absolutely cannot and you will not and you do not have money or you have an agreement with your spouse that you will not fund other people's projects, because that is also a real thing, then I would say go on to IMDb. Create an account. I know you gotta create an account. That sucks, but it's not that hard. So go on to IMDb, Letterboxd, all these different places. Those two are probably the two most important, and rate their movies or rate their, if they have one movie, like a feature or something, rate their feature, write a nice review, find it on Amazon, write a nice review. I mean, those things, like, it really helps. Like I do. It helps me personally, like as an emotional thing. Every time I get a rating on IMDb, it makes me feel better. And it helps my little tick of like 5.5 or whatever I'm at now go up a little higher, you know? So I would say, yeah, go on IMDb, go on Letterboxd, go on Rotten Tomatoes, give it an audience review, like all those things. Like if you spend like 20 minutes, like just reviewing one person's movie on three places, that'll make a huge difference to that filmmaker. And it doesn't cost anything. It just costs your time. So that's what I would say would be the best way to support your friends who are filmmakers. If you cannot have money, give money, then give some time and review their stuff. Write a nice comment on some of their short films, you know, give it an extra view, like, you know, give a like. Like those things matter. Yeah, I would do that. One other thing I really want to sneak in here really quick. We have a new review on Apple Podcasts. So I want to read this really quick. This is like completely just snuck in here. But we got this on the day before my birthday, March 10th. From Atlantis 70, they say making movies is hardly fun. I'm loving the podcast. I tried leaving reviews, but they don't populate? This is the third I'm attempting to leave. Hope it works. I didn't say that. I added that. It did work. I make TV and movies too, and highlight underrepresented groups like naturists and disabled, among others. Eric and I have been talking about me coming on as a guest, and I'm excited. I'm in the industry, but more so a fan. Love what you do. It's thorough and honest podcast that encourages in a realistic way. Tim Chismar. So Tim, can't remember if Eric has actually pitched you yet, but I'm sure he will soon. And we'd love to have you on the show as long as the timing works out. But thank you so much for the lovely review. It really means a lot. And damn you, Apple Podcasts, for not making it hard for people to leave reviews. I can only imagine how many reviews that have been left that did not get populated. You darn system, you. But yes, thank you so much for the review. Anyone who leaves us a review, it makes such a big difference. You can also send us questions, comments, or suggestions to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Again, if you really love the show, that iTunes review would be amazing. Our Apple Podcasts now. Also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and MMIH Podcast, and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Kate Madison, Christopher Dane, and Neil Osman for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being awesome. Thanks to y'all for listening, and talk to y'all next week. He was there. It was basically for the longest time. It was like until the first time he'd wake up at like 3 or so.
Yeah. There he is. It would be like